It now falls on me and is a great pleasure to introduce Anne Belahowski. Anne is past president of CHICA, the Canadian Society, one of our sister societies. And this session is a Weber teleclass, which is sponsored by Gojo. Please would you welcome Anne to the platform.
Thank you. It gives me great pleasure to be here. This is actually my third year in a row coming to your convention. And I have to say that I'm hooked, that I really do enjoy the company of your board members and the people that organize your conference. And I always get value out of the conference. So it's definitely one of my favorites to attend. So I was delighted when they asked me, although I thought, stronger together. I'm used to speaking about scientific topics. And so to talk about something that is really motivational and about how we come together as groups and work together is not something I've talked about a lot, but certainly I have in my previous role. And so I do have a bit of experience. I thought I didn't, but I do, really. Oh, let us wait for my next. Okay. So, when we're talking about stronger together, it's really about, I want to really for you to think about three things, if you remember nothing else from this talk. Three things. Collaboration is always valuable. It does take work, but bad, dirty word, work. And the products are not always tangible, but there definitely is always something that comes from it. So what I'm going to talk about, I have a number of objectives, and I want to talk about, describe how we can be stronger together through communities of practice, to describe the benefits of a community of practice and building that community, and to provide some tips and tools to work effectively. Because in order to work effectively within a community, you can't lose yourself. You have to stay true to yourself, and you have to be willing to share your ideas and to have the courage to stand up when you hear some ideas that you think, this is not going to work. We can't do this. You have to have the courage to stand up and say, I'm not so sure about that one. And last but not least, I want to renew the enthusiasm that you do have for collaboration. So why do we collaborate? To build stronger infection prevention and control programs in societies. When I was looking back through the archives for CHICA Canada, I realized that our societies have really been talking and working together since the very beginning. So really, the big three, APIC, CHICA, and IPS, have been working together since the early 70s. And we have worked on some very important projects and done some great work together. We've learned from each other, and that's the whole purpose of a community of practice, is to learn from each other. Never go in thinking, I know it all, and I'm giving you my thoughts, and you're going to do what I want you to do. To create a sense of connectedness and relevance. Because although we all speak English in our societies, we do talk different language sometimes. We do have different words, and I know that because when I've gone out to dinner with you, I need a code book. What was that? So we do use different language in different ways. So why? I'll go on to my next. So I just want to leave you with this. Give you this one quote: in organizations, real power and energy is generated through relationships. And the pattern of relationships and the capacities to form them are more important than the tasks, functions, roles, and positions. And in our busy world, where we're so connected with IT, we often lose that connection and that relationship with other people. And it is so very important that we connect on a face-to-face basis, on a regular basis, to remain connected. And I have a very good personal example from that. In my job, I had the unfortunate situation where I started a new job at the peak of an outbreak of C. difficile, and it was a very bad outbreak. And in fact, I had already been hired, and the day before, the weekend on the Friday, I went in with a government organization to review the organization, and on the Monday, I got to be the manager of the infection prevention program. So that was... So be careful what you say in the review, because you get to do it on Monday. And very shortly, not 3 months after we came out of outbreak, our organization went through accreditation. And one of the things that the accreditor said was that as a result of the outbreak, there was magic within the organization. And we had built relationships that they felt would last us into the future and would prevent us from getting into that situation again. And I truly believe that, and I do think that that's what's made the difference going forward. So, what is a community of practice? A community of practice are groups of people who share a concern or passion for something that they do, and who interact regularly to learn how to do it better. And of those who have in the audience who are not infection prevention and control professionals, know the passion that we have as ICPs. And they often think we're a little crazy. And maybe we are. But it isn't just about infection prevention and control professionals. It is about joining with other groups and learning how to speak with other groups and other organizations so that you work together for a common purpose. Because often, and I don't know if it was the same with you, but in Canada or in North America, what we found was that as the safety movement moved forward, infection prevention all of a sudden and preventing healthcare-associated infections became very sexy, and it became competitive. And the organizations competed with each other for the shared agenda, for the shared resources, and we were jockeying and not working together. And I think we've learned from that and we are moving forward, but it took a while to figure that out. So where have communities of practice been used before? Lots of different places. International banks, car manufacturers have used them, government agencies, and healthcare. And the most experience I've had with it is with government agencies and healthcare. I'm from Ontario and near Toronto, so very close to the epicenter of SARS. And after SARS, our government realized that our organizations were very siloed, that we talked a different language, even in infection prevention, between public health and the hospitals and the long-term care settings, and that we would get on a teleconference and we would say something and everybody would interpret it differently. And so we had to build, what we built was organizations called regional infection control networks. And we broke the province into 14 sections. And I got to lead a lot of that development work. And so develop communities of practice throughout our province. So why aren't they more prevalent? Because the primary output, knowledge, and knowledge is power, isn't tangible. It's often hard to describe. It's not easy to build and sustain communities of practice. And organizations need to support and nurture them. And when we have cutbacks, and I know that you have had cutbacks in healthcare, the first thing that happens is that organizations say, we don't want you to leave the organization. We do not want you to go to meetings outside. We want you to spend your time within the organization. And they don't realize the value that they get when you leave your organization. And in fact, when you go outside, you talk about your organization, you become more embedded. You're more likely to stay. So what are three crucial characteristics of a community of practice? There's the domain, the community, and the practice. So the domain or the passion, I added that myself. So it's an area of interest, something that really sparks what you is in your core. It's a shared commitment. It is competence that distinguishes members from other people. So things that make us certainly different. And we talked about this at dinner last night. What is it that makes infection prevention and control people different than everybody else? How do we sell that to our organizations? And how do we ensure that we have value that is universal? And so we, Julie and I were talking about, in Canada, a couple of years ago, what we did was our organization gave a stamp of approval. We set up a process to review education for infection prevention and control, and set up a process through the society that we would give our stamp of approval, and only those that had would get endorsement. And it's working really well, so because we get to vet what the programs have, and are they adding value. So the community, it's the members. So we need to build relationships to learn from each other. And that's why quite a number of years ago, between Sheikah at APIC and IPS, we decided that the only way to truly build relationships was if we attended each other's conferences, if we met together to understand what the issues were that we were dealing with, and some of the pressures and some of the learnings. To engage in joint activities and decisions. So you can thank Sheikah Canada for the idea for the IFIC run. Walker Crawl, you guys added the Walker Crawl, which is good. I like that. So because we believed that as strong organizations, we had a duty to help other organizations, and IFIC, that's what IFIC does. They help other organizations, they help individuals from poor countries, from lower resource countries, come together and learn about infection prevention and control. And I think that's the great benefit, and the money that we use creates scholarship, or that we get from the walk or the run, definitely goes to scholarships and new learning. And it's amazing the ideas. I was very fortunate last year to go to the conference in South Africa. And it's amazing. The issues are all the same. Everybody says we're in a different place. We have different issues. We have different problems. Some of the degree to which the problems that we have may be different. But the issues are universal across the board. And to hear people who have very few resources talk about overcoming challenges, and they had some tremendous ideas that would work anywhere, anywhere in the world. So the practice, where the rubber hits the road. So the members are the practitioners. They develop a shared repertoire of resources from experience, from stories, and tools. It takes time, and it does take shared interaction. So what are some of the typical activities of a community of practice? So problem solving, can we work on this issue and brainstorm some ideas? I'm stuck. And we talked about our journals and how our journals are not listed in CINAHL, and how can we come together to improve our journals between the societies. Requests for information, where can I find this information, or seeking experience. Has anybody dealt with this difficult issue, and can they help me? And so we do a lot of this between our chapters, and I'm not sure what you guys call your chapters, but branches. So in your branches, where you share ideas and seek experience, especially from more seasoned ICPs, about their thoughts and ideas and things that have worked. It's about coordination and synergy. So, for example, can we combine our purchasing power to get a better discount? Can we discuss developments? Have you seen the new IPNC best practice document? And we found that we have a lot of guidelines that are coming out within our area, especially in Ontario, but across the country. And the best way to get that information out of a guideline and into best practice was to come together as groups and talk about what the gaps were in your organization and what the difficulties you had in implementing the guideline and getting some good ideas. And also, not only good ideas, but also some support or a way to frame something to take it back to your senior, your whatever it might be, We need to establish that program in our facility. And we've done that recently with one of our sister organizations who are dealing with a massive C. diff outbreak right now across 7 facilities. And they've come to learn from us, from our experience with C. diff. Not that we are the experts, but our learnings from that recent outbreak. So reusing assets. I have a business case I wrote last year. So as Tracy talked about, we should borrow shamelessly. Never reinvent the wheel. If someone has already built it, use it. And the thing is, you'll find, and always share. Share your ideas, share your tools. I know that when I first started in infection prevention and control, it often surprised me when people would take their information and they would hold it very close to their chest. And I've got a great idea, but you can't see it. And I've got a great tool, but you can't see it. And I have to tell you that when we started out as regional infection control networks, my peers and myself were very much that way because we wanted to be the best. We wanted to do it first. And then we realized that the more we shared our ideas, the better they got. And our initial idea that looked like a straw man became an amazing artistic drawing of a real human being. And so it just takes that initial step to move forward and share your ideas. So map knowledge and identify gaps. And to document your projects, one of the things that we have not done well in infection prevention and control is documenting the amazing work that we do. So I'm going to do a plug for your journal, and I'm going to tell you that the great work you do and the great experiences that you have within your organizations, write them up. Submit them to the journal. And there's certainly a lot of guidance from the editor and from the other reviewers to assist you to make it a better article if you feel that it's not where it needs to be. So why belong? Knowledge is an asset that needs to be managed strategically. And so we need to think about it as infection prevention and control. We have the knowledge. We have years and years of knowledge that other groups have taken our knowledge and built toolkits with it and then turned it and said it was theirs. That's okay because they have added learnings to it, taught us more about culture and building relationships and making those toolkits work. The economy runs on knowledge, and knowledge of any field is too complex for any individual to cover. I think that I could be in infection prevention and control for 50 years, and I would still not know everything that I need to know. And so I need to rely on my colleagues. I've become an expert in certain fields and rely on others for the other sections. So what are the guidelines? How do we make it successful? It has to be voluntary. There has to be self-organization. You have to have a problem, and it should be problem-focused. And let me tell you, we have lots of problems, so that's not a problem. You have to have distributed leadership and transparency. And I think, looking back at some of the work that we've had across the societies, one of the problems, and perhaps why some of the work was not sustained and was not supported by our membership, was that the leadership was stagnant, and the membership didn't turn over enough, and people didn't feel connected to it. But there was some amazing work that was done. And so we just need to figure out how to make it more transparent and more distributed leadership. It has to be accessible. There has to be a shared identity. We need to believe in the same things. We need to have similar ideas, and it needs to be sustainable. So, what's the value to your organization or to organizations in general? It can help drive strategy. So, when you come to this meeting, you get new ideas, you bring those ideas to your organization, and it can drive the strategy within your organization. You create new products. You look at the poster presentations, and you think, that's a great idea. I'm going to take that back, and I'm going to do something with it. It helps you to solve problems more quickly in the sense that someone else has already worked through the first few stages and you just have to take it to your organization and work it through. Transfers best practice. Any idea how long it takes to move best practice into best evidence? I mean, best evidence into best practice? Any thoughts? Well, research out of the IHI by Bayless and Borland said it was 15 to 17 years. That's way too long. Unbelievable, right? And I think that by working together and by having guidelines and by working through the gaps in our organizations, we can make that a lot faster, certainly less than 17 years. So the members develop professional skills. You help companies recruit and retain talent. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the tools. And I found an excellent book by Connie Deacon, and it's called Talk Less, Say More. And so we want to do three things. We want to connect with people, we want to convey our message, and we want to convince people. So in order to connect, you have to give people what they want and value so they'll tune in. And we talked about this at dinner as well last night. How do we as societies figure out what the other group wants? What do they need from us, and what do we need from them, and how do we talk about it in such a way that we can give value and add value to each other? Convey. Use portion control to make your point. This is something that I learned the long, hard, painful way, especially when talking to senior leadership. I remember once we had to do a major review. We had some adverse events related to sterilization and disinfection. And so the government decided that every hospital within the organization, within the province, would do an audit just before Christmas. And so we had a 4-site organization with many, many clinics and central processing. And we had to do a review, and we did that review. And then we had to meet with myself and my senior manager, met with our chief operating officer. And the first words out of his mouth were, "I'm not sure why I'm meeting with you. I'm not sure that there's going to be value to this, but I think I better because the ministry's looking." And so we met with him, and we had developed a very long, of all the issues, it was 5 pages long. And he got really angry, and he slammed his arm down on the desk. And my manager, I could see her eyes start to well. And I just looked at him, and I thought, "You're got to be kidding me." But I had learned a very valuable lesson from that. And he taught me something that I'm going to carry through the rest of my career, and it was when you have to bring something that important with lots of bucks attached to it, because one of the initiatives was going to cost the hospital about $2 million. And he said to us, "You need to have a 5-year plan for this. You need to tell me what I absolutely must do today, what I can do next year, and what I can do in 3 years from now, and how am I going to do that?" And so we did tell him the must-dos. You cannot do this and not have an adverse event that could cripple the hospital. And one of them was related to CJD. And the initiatives that we did, within that, after that conversation, we had a CJD case that was undetected. And the initiatives that we had done protected us from an adverse event. And so from then on, he was sold. But it's unfortunate that we had to have that adverse event. But we certainly did learn from that. So use portion control. And one of the things that Connie Deacon talks about in her book is talk in threes. So if you have to have an important message, keep it simple and keep it in triads. And a lot of that's how people remember, in threes. Convince. So the last piece you have to do is to create commitment. Get people to buy in. To what you want. And you have to understand what they need. And that takes really good listening skills, to really understand from your senior leadership team, what is it they want from you? What information do they need to make their decisions? So create a shared pool of meaning. This is another great book. It's about critical conversations, because a great deal of what we do is critical conversations. And it's being able to be in a meeting. So when people purposefully withhold meaning from one another, individually smart people can do collectively stupid things. Have you, each and every one of us have been in a meeting where the leader of that meeting, the person that was running the agenda, was a very strong personality and didn't listen to the input that was coming from the group, didn't watch people's body language, and didn't realize when people were dropping into silence. Silence wasn't about agreeing. Silence was, I don't have a voice here. There's no point in speaking up because people won't listen. And so as great leaders of meetings, we need to understand that our ideas are important. But if we don't sell it, if the people in the group don't believe it, they're going to walk out of that meeting and they're going to talk about it outside. And it will be much more destructive, the work that goes on outside of the committee, than what happens inside the committee. And so you have to watch for that. Unfortunately, as you guys know, I don't always bite my tongue. And I will frequently be in a meeting, and I'm looking back and forth, and who believes what all of this is, everybody's saying here? And so sometimes I will step where no one else will go and say a truth that everyone is thinking. Sometimes it works for me, not always, but sometimes it works. One of my colleagues said, she's invited me to speak in November, and she said, yes, we've invited you to speak, Anne, because we know that you take no prisoners. I guess it's a referral to when I was I used to be an Army nurse way back when. So I guess that was the thought. So I just want to, I think I'm actually just on time. So that's my last point, just to say, make sure that when you're in this kind of an environment, that you listen to what people are saying and you listen to what they're not saying. And when we were building community as a practice in Ontario, the thing that we found that we had to do is that we had to market continually. We had to we took on 4 new networks at a time, and we had to give people opportunity to voice their concerns, to describe to us how they felt it wasn't going to work in their region, to talk amongst themselves. And it was really frustrating because I was a year ahead of them, and I was like, come on, I just want to get on with it. Do the Nike thing. Just do it. But I realized that we couldn't do it that way. We had to give them time to talk about it and to work it through. And usually in the morning, all of that would happen, and then by the afternoon, they would see where we were going, and they felt there was value, and they felt that they could do it in their region and that they could maybe change it a little, but we would go in the same direction. And so although it was painful and though it took longer, it definitely was worth it to do it that way. So if you're forming a committee, you're forming a group, and you have a very important project, don't always include the people that you know are going to sit around the table and agree with you. Find the people that you know will challenge you, that you know will not always agree with you, that will sometimes drive you crazy, because if you work it out in that meeting, it'll be much easier to work it out outside and to get the project to work with a whole bunch of different people. So thank you very much. It was a great pleasure to speak with you, and I look forward to seeing you at all of the events and for the rest of the conference. So thank you so much.
We do have time for questions for Anne. So is there anybody with any questions for Anne? I've got the light in my eyes, so I'm struggling to see. Can you wave at me if there is? No. No question. Yes, gentleman there.
Hello. It's not so much a question, but I'm a biomedical scientist with 30 years experience working in microbiology, and I feel we have a key part to play in infection prevention. I was very pleased to hear you talking about communities of practice, and I would just urge all of you to go back to your hospitals and try and engage with the microbiology departments, and not just the consultants who might be your infection control lead, but the biomedical scientists who are actually doing the work. And try and find a representative from the biomedical scientists who can meet with you and try and move things forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Anne, I wonder whether you've had experience of including various professions in your communities of practice.
No, I'm very glad that you said that, because really you do need to include all of those folks within your organizations, and we meet on a regular basis. We do have our medical microbiologists, our infectious disease physicians, our antibiotic stewardship pharmacists. Those groups come together so that you're not working on separate issues. There are so many things that we can do together, much more. And in fact, there are communities of practice with other folks within your organization that sometimes you don't think about. And one of the ones that I've developed within my organization is with environmental services. Because I realized that when we got into, I know all the hospitals are really pushed, and we're running, our medical beds are running at 110% capacity. They closed one of the hospitals in our city to adults and turned it just to peds. And so our emergency departments are seeing more than 5,000 a month, and it's going up and up and up. And so we were not talking to each other within the hospital to be able to deal with that kind of pressure. And the housekeepers, all of the day work shifted to the end of the day, and nobody was telling the housekeeping department, we need you to have extra manpower on later in the day to deal with this, to deal with these changes, to deal with this work. And so we talked to each other on a much more frequent basis. And before I left, I went and sat in one of their offices and said, pressure's hot. The critical care beds are full to capacity. Do you have the resources that you need? Are you going to be able to meet the demand? And do you have people telling you what you need to know to do your job? So there are lots of different folks within our organizations that we can develop different relationships and communication with to make our work sustainable and much more effective.
Thank you. Could I ask you to just thank Anne again for delivering our EM Cottrell lecture this morning?